and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, can you be gay and Muslim? Can you also be a religious leader, an imam? Well, we'll meet someone who is all three in just a moment. And Senator Bill Nelson has turned away from visiting a detention center where immigrant children are being held in South Florida. We'll hear more about that in a moment. Later, alumni of the elite Berkeley Prep School in Tampa speak out against one of their fellow alumni who's the head of Homeland Security and defending the incarceration of children. But first, a listener comment about Monday's interview with former state chief financial officer Alex Sink, who's lobbying in Washington, D.C. against federal budget cuts to the State Department budget. Here's what one listener had to say.
The show you had on Alex Sink, who was lobbying for increased or at least maintained funding for the State Department. The State Department has some usefulness for all Americans, especially having embassies overseas to help Americans who get in trouble in other countries. It also helps to facilitate diplomacy so that wars can be avoided. But in many ways, the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the State Department are used to promote American exceptionalism and American capitalism. For example, you'll remember that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, went all over the world promoting fracking and other environmentally destructive practices at the behest of the environmental destroyer industries. The State Department is an arm of U.S. hegemony and imperialism. And I don't agree with why Trump is cutting it, but nor do I agree that it should be doing what it does. Maybe if it would have decreased funding, it might focus on what everyone can agree on is good for it to do.
Well, there you have a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. Our first guest today is perhaps the only openly gay imam in the U.S. He'll be taking part in this week's Pride events in St. Petersburg. He is Imam Da'i Abdullah. Abdullah was born and raised in Detroit, where his parents were Southern Baptists. At the age of 15, he came out. And at the age of 33, while studying in China, Abdullah converted to Islam and went on to study the religion in Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. But as a gay man in America, he saw that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Muslims had unmet spiritual needs, and he became an imam to provide community support. I spoke with him earlier this week. Imam Da'i Abdullah, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, I understand that you are the only openly gay imam in the Americas. Is that right?
Well, that would be true. Originally, it was the first openly gay imam in the Western Hemisphere. But over the last, probably the last 15, 16 years, there have been a number of people who have come out. And so now, worldwide, we have, my last count, which was about a year ago, around 12 people who, in some form or another, have been publicly out as LGBT Muslims, imams.
Now, I thought the Muslim religion said that you couldn't be a gay person or a lesbian person in the religion.
Well, this is one of the problems that the media has failed to do the kind of research and put forth. The image that they promote is one that helps sell newspapers, it helps sell advertising, and is not necessarily a true representation of the nearly 2 billion Muslims from around the world, meaning that they really have not looked at the great diversity of how Muslims are in their day-to-day lives and their following of the Islamic faith, particular tenets of it, throughout the world. Responding to that question directly, that the Quran itself actually supports the diversity of human sexuality rather than denigrates it. What the problem is that, particularly in the West, the association of the Lot or Lot story within Judaism and Christianity is assumed to be the same understanding about the Lot story in the Quran, and there are significant differences in how they're interpreted. Therefore, it's just a sort of like a waterfall in which those particular ideas of what it means have flowed into what we call the issue of sexuality in Islam.
Could you tell us the story?
Okay, well, there are three different aspects of the story. The first is that the Judaic concept of inhospitality is the origin. But due to the historical framework of how that story passed into both the Eastern and the Western idea of Christianity, brought in two additional frameworks. One, the idea of pedophilia, which was an issue in the Western part of the Christian empire, in a theological framework. And then the Eastern one, it was one of the sexual diversity. And as Muslims received people who were from the Jewish faith and from the various Christian faiths, aspects of the Christian faith, came into Islam, they brought certain references into the study or into the concept of what did those stories mean, and they got absorbed into the Islamic ideology, or what's the term I want to use, a social mythology related to how Islam looks at sexual orientation.
Lot was the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, right?
That's correct. But the reality is that the Jewish meaning that it was inhospitality was being the sin of the people of Lot, and then changing it to the pedophilia, the idea that it was about male-male sex, came in through the Christian aspect. And then, as I said, Muslims moving into the Islamic faith, they brought those beliefs, those cultural understandings into Islam, because Muslims had no background, no association with those earlier two in terms of being adherents to the faith. And therefore, what they brought in was something that was based on, as I look at it historically, on myths that came into the faith and explained those particular ideals that are in the Quran.
Is the story itself of Sodom and Gomorrah in the Quran?
Yes, it is. It's there. But the way in which it is presented, it raises the issues of what were those acts that the men themselves were heterosexual. And so it talks about the concept of rape, power and control, and people using that as a way of controlling innocence and punishing people, abusing their sense of power. And then on other aspects of the Quran, because it's mentioned 11 times in the Quran itself, it really focuses in on the harms that human beings do to other human beings who are innocent. So there are many stories that are relayed in the Quran that talks about this particular issue, and Sodom and Gomorrah is just one of several. Mm. Therefore, the real inference is on abuse of power rather than the actual aspect of sexual orientation, because the Quran itself in verses 24, in Surah 24, or chapter 24, verse 31, which talks about marriage, basically men and women's relationships, begins with 24:30 and goes to 24:32. It emphasizes several things. First, the men should not gawk at women. They should not spend their time gawking at women, number one. Number two, it discusses the types of men that Muslim women do not have to veil before, meaning that to show a certain deference. And those are her male relatives. And then the second part of it also states those men include men who have no desire for women and children who have no understanding of sexuality. So who are those men who have no desire for women? Well, I've had lectures on this, and for some people, they say, oh, it must be old men. But this was before Viagra. So because you don't have the vigor, it doesn't mean you don't have the intention or the thought. Secondly, we can go to Arab literature, particularly the 1001 Nights, which expressed the literature of the medieval time. And we see that stories of Scheherazade, where in her 1001 Nights episodes, she talks about one particular story where the queen and her consorts are having sex with the male slaves. So the form of eunuchs there was not similar to like in China where they remove all the genitalia, but there they removed the scrotum so they could not impregnate. So there was desire and ability to do so then. And then you have those who just have no desire, no sexual interest in women. So then the question becomes, who do they have a desire for?
Well, we're talking with Imam.
And finally, in 2432, it speaks to marry from the single among you. And within Islam, to have be divorced is not a stigma. But anyone who is single, of sound mind, and of good conscience is eligible to marry. And it has no reference to gender. However, in that same verse, it says, even if the person comes, the one you want to marry comes from your male and female slaves, there's a historical aspect of slavery, sexual slavery, meaning concubinage, and because of that understanding in the Islamic, in the Muslim, I should say, most Muslim culture. Therefore, the idea, and there are many legal cases you can find dealing with this, that whoever is possessed by your right hand, under this sexual slavery, you could have sex with them, and that was regardless of their gender. So we have this conflict there in terms of people understanding it. But deep down, the world reality is that because you know this understanding of the sexual history, the history of sexual slavery there, that reference only means that those people have to be equal as marriage partners. And sometimes in Christianity, they refer to as being evenly yoked, and a slave and a master are not evenly yoked. Therefore, the slave has to be freed, and then the slave can make the decision to marry the person as a free person, a person of equal value and standard within the society. And that's what that relates to. So as we reevaluate what the Quranic message and guidance reveals, we see that it's not always based on sexual orientation, but on sexual ethics, so that there's a harmony between the parties who are seeking this marriage.
But Imam, that's your interpretation. I mean, there are countries that are predominantly Muslim that persecute GLBT people. In some cases, you can be put to death for being gay or lesbian. Isn't that true?
Yes, that's very true, but that is a tradition that has come through over 1,000 years of believing something to be true, but that doesn't mean that's the case. This is when people raise that, I says, well, yeah, but that's true. People used to believe the earth is flat, but we know that's not true today. So just because people believe something, and numerous people believe it for a long period of time, doesn't mean that it's accurate, nor does it mean that it's really true. So one of the issues that we fail to put into this process, and when you speak in those terms, is that people in power will maintain that power through a process of saying these are the rules, and if you break these rules, there are punishments for them. So those are social mores that are there, but there are many other people in other societies who don't do that. So is there a necessarily truth that everyone does it? It's not. So we have to consider these things as not being monolithic and unchangeable, but that during certain time periods in the history of whatever it is that we're doing research on or learning more about, that there are times when they have imposed harsh treatments on a variety of different things. But does that mean we have to do it today? With our knowledge and understanding of the world today, do we need to do it today? And in many instances, no.
Well, we're talking with Imam Dayi Abdullah, and he'll be speaking twice in the coming few days as part of the Pride celebrations in St. Petersburg. Imam Abdullah was born and raised in Detroit, where his parents were Southern Baptists. At age 15, he came out to them, and at age 33, while studying in China, Abdullah converted to Islam. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So, you know, I'm wondering, what is the ultimate authority in the Muslim faith? I mean, you can maybe go to the Roman Catholic faith and point to the Pope as the ultimate authority. In Islam, where does the ultimate authority come from for interpreting the Quran?
Well, it comes from several different sources, but the most important one is the personal relationship each individual has with their creator, meaning that one, as the Prophet Muhammad experienced and is chronicled in the Quran, is that it's the personal connection. In Arabic, is referred to as ikra, and that is a moment when the human spirit and the creator basically touch in the unseen, and I refer to it in the subconscious, and it's at that point that one recognizes that they are connected, and it's that relationship that grows there. Now, people can study a variety of different sources. Some of them I find to be very difficult to follow in today's world because of the way in which they were developed, you know, over the last 1,300, 1,400 years, meaning the hadith, which are basically stories, and the way in which they were done at that time, you know, recorded at that time, it had a sense of reliability and that in validity. But in today's world, a lot of it is spurious and has no real logic to it because they are responses to cultural needs or the needs of an empire ruling over masses of people. So it's a big difference that is there. And so we, you know, as I said before, too often the pat answer has a lot of, if you do a lot of digging, you see that that pat answer is really based upon a lot of other factors that have been weaved into a certain concept. For example, the legal prohibition against same-sex relationships is based on the problem that was associated with opposite-sex relationships, meaning of someone who was married having a sexual relationship with someone who was not married, and therefore it was a charge against the individual who were doing so. So there was a punishment for it. But that got switched around because of the concept of illegal sexual relationships. And since same-sex people could not get married by the laws established by Muslim clerics and jurists, therefore it became made an illegal impossibility that yet they could still punish someone for something that was just natural to them as being who they are. But the people did not want to follow that part, particularly during the time when Islam went into the Persian Empire. Prior to that, respect for the diversity of sexual orientations and representations were not so heavily monitored until that time.
Dai, you came out when you were 15, yet you converted to Islam at the age of 33. How did you become an imam? How did you become a spiritual leader within the Muslim faith? Did anybody object to you becoming an imam?
Well, the process is one that is one of two ways. The more traditional way is when a person would start around 4 years old, then they would learn to recite the Quran and then go through that particular school of thought or madhhab. A person would then become more attuned by studying with the imam that's present, and then they would become eventually an imam of that particular school of thought in that particular community. But in today's world, the Islamic educational system has been dispersed into the more Western academic framework. And so now a person can actually do studies in the Arabic language, Arabic history, and also live in Arab cultures, a diversity of them around the world, and learn about being Muslim. and then actually take additional studies, graduate level studies, on Islamic law, various aspects of other formulations within a Muslim society, and use that as a foundation to enter the role of imam, meaning that you become a person who represents an idea of what the theology presents from a particular school of thought. There are at least five of them, so they're not all saying the same thing about every particular subject matter. For the Hanafi, are much more, as we would use the term, liberal in their interpretation versus the Hanbali, who are much more strict, like the Wahhabists and Salafists that you find in the Gulf states, but also you find pockets of them throughout other Muslim countries around the world.
So did somebody have to okay you? Did somebody have to say, Dayi, you're okay, you can become an imam?
Well, I went through the process of studying for 3 years at the Graduate School of Islamic Social Sciences. And because of my background as a linguist in Chinese and Arabic, my background in law as well as Islamic law, and the theological studies that I have done throughout my lifetime, both in Christianity, I did some studies in Judaism as well, and then the Islamic studies, theological studies, it put me in a position of being well prepared to become an imam. Now, at the time I was about ready to graduate, it was revealed that I was gay, and the organization said to me that I was not quote-unquote qualified to be an imam because of my moral, quote-unquote, standing, yet the process of me becoming an imam was not hindered through that. And as several imams in the Washington, D.C. area have noted, is that I provided a service as an imam to a community that is not being serviced by the general, out-of-the-mill imams that come out, because they're refusing to provide services to Muslims who are the LGBT women and youth that need these particular services, meaning imam service, pastoral services, and including those particular things, such as even, funeral services and things like that, marriage counseling, all of that.
At the mosque that you once ran in Washington, D.C., male and female worship together.
That's correct. Yeah. As they do in Mecca. I call it the Mecca system, where when you're doing Hajj and actually doing Umrah, which is a non-Hajj time period, people pray at the Kaaba, the most sacred place within the Islamic structure. And then there are no gender restrictions, though I've heard that they're trying to segregate women now, and I hope that they never do that, because it takes away from the true essence of being there at that holy site.
Well, one last question, because I've got you really represent progressive values, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
So you're committed to progressive values. Could you tell us why, based on your Muslim faith, that there's a coherency or a connection between progressive values and your Muslim faith?
Well, basically, the Quran has always been a forward-moving and forward-thinking theology, meaning that throughout Islamic history, about every 150 to 200 years, there's always been a spiritual revival and an intellectual reformation in terms of how does Islam work best in this particular time and in this particular place. As you will see, in many places, Islam has many tenets that are similar, but how it's represented culturally is very different. Therefore, the Quran encourages us to look at where we are and what we're doing for our particular time, and then apply to our contemporary times. That doesn't mean that those answers for today will be the answers for another 150 years into the future. And then they will be evaluated exactly what they are. very quickly in my TED talk, I asked the question of the audience, 150 years from now, we'll have human beings on other planets doing whatever they'll be doing. I said, so the question is that there'll be Muslims there, and the question is, which way is Kaaba? And so they leaned forward looking for the answer to them. I don't know, but the Muslims of 150 years from now will have that answer. Therefore, we cannot say that what happened 1,500 years ago is the only answer for the rest of human time. Impossible.
Well, Imam Dayyid Abdullah, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
You're more than welcome, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
That was Imam Dayyid Abdullah. He'll be speaking this Thursday at the First Presbyterian Church, 701 Beach Drive, Northeast in St. Petersburg, as part of the fourth annual Pride Worship Celebration. He's perhaps the first openly gay imam in the United States, and he'll also be speaking at the MCC Church in St. Petersburg on Sunday. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lurie, and this is Radioactivity. U.S. Senator Bill Nelson was denied entry to a detention center for migrant children in South Florida yesterday. Nelson, along with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was seeking to inspect living conditions at a temporary shelter in Homestead, but they were both turned away.
They obviously are hiding something. They are using the excuse, get this, you have to apply 2 weeks in advance. This is what the deputy secretary told me this morning. And I said, obviously, that is balderdash. You know better than telling me that we've got to fill out a form of 2 weeks ahead of time when children's lives are at stake. So they are obviously trying to cover up. They don't want us to see it. This is not a good reflection on the Trump administration, that it is just perpetuating this policy of ripping children apart, and they don't want to be held accountable. They know they have done wrong. They're starting to get this reminded every moment, and yet they are now embarrassed and don't want us to check on the comfort and welfare of these children. This is absolutely ridiculous. I am ashamed of this administration that they are doing this.
That's U.S. Senator Bill Nelson speaking yesterday at Homestead, Florida, where he was trying to inspect living conditions at a temporary shelter for children in Homestead, children who've been separated from their parents because their parents came to the U.S. illegally. We're going to get a legal perspective on immigration right now from Dilip Patel, who is an attorney with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney in Tampa. He's an expert on immigration law. And Dilip, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
Happy to be here, and this is a very important topic near and dear to our hearts.
It sure is, and it's being debated all over the country. So, okay, first of all, the question is it a crime to come to the U.S. Crossing the border illegally?
In general, it is not a crime to come to the U.S. It is a crime to cross at points other than designated border crossing points.
All right, so if you just show up and let's say that you ask for political asylum, that in itself is not a crime?
No.
So, go ahead, I'm sorry.
The problem is that some of these ports of entry are turning people away from making the asylum claim.
How historically, can you give us any historical context to this? I mean, how often in U.S. history did people come to the border seeking political asylum?
Well, that's been, you know, the law since 1952 under the Immigration Act. And the U.S. is a party to international treaties and has obligations to have a process for asylum seekers who are fleeing violence or persecution back in their home country.
Now,
that's always been the case. Now, historically, up until very recently, this did not happen. And it's only happening because of a change in policy to prosecute as a crime anybody who appears at the border other than at a designated port of entry.
Let's say that a parent and their child go to a place that's not a port of entry. Let's say they cross the Rio Grande River, if that's possible. I don't know if that's any possible any longer these days. But let's say they cross illegally at a point other than a designated border crossing. Are both the child and the parent guilty of a crime, or have they possibly committed a crime?
The parent. The child is not capable under the age. It's generally a misdemeanor, not a felony.
That's what I was going to ask you, because when I hear that, you know, in some quarters, the people that cross at illegal points are called criminals, I always assume what they're talking about is that's a felony, but it's not a felony.
No, it's a misdemeanor. And in the past, we didn't prosecute those under the criminal system. You know, not everybody who commits a crime in the U.S. is automatically prosecuted for the crime. The prosecutors have discretion to decide, are we going to spend our valuable resources in prosecuting this particular individual? There are many a time when, you know, prosecutors will not prosecute, and they will evaluate all the factors that come into play.
If they don't prosecute, what happens to the person then, typically?
They could be referred over for regular immigration processing, immigration detention, where they can be kept together with the child. And once they're processed, if it is determined that they're removable, they would be deported together.
Mm-hmm.
If it is determined that they have a valid claim for asylum, then that claim is processed.
Let me ask you, over the years, has it been common for U.S. immigration officials to separate immigrant children from their parents if they've crossed illegally?
No, it has not, because prosecutors used to use their discretion. And in some cases, they were turned back at the border. In other cases, their applications were processed through the immigration process. It's only recently that the current administration has decided what they call the zero tolerance policy, where anyone crossing the border is automatically prosecuted for the crime. And they did this knowing that if they do that, then they have to separate the children. This is their way of justifying the separation of children from parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this whole controversy about separating children from parents, is there anything else that you'd like to point out that you think the public needs to know, or perhaps the press is not covering very well?
You know, the reality is that the current administration is putting forward arguments that are simply not true, and they keep repeating them in the hope that, you know, the general public will buy into it, and it's a diversionary tactic. Separating children from parents as a way of deterring migration is simply bad policy, and history has shown that it will not work. As a nation, we are much better than that. Our listeners should not give in to fear-mongering that somehow, unless we do this, the country will be flooded with illegal immigration. Simply not true.
Because we already have the means to deal with people who come over the border without going through the checkpoints.
Exactly. And, you know, some of the solutions are difficult. Part of the solution requires an international approach. We have to address the conditions in the countries from which the pressure to immigrate exists. These people are fleeing violence and persecution back home. And there has to be a political solution for that.
Well, Dilip Patel, thank you so much for coming on WMNF. I should say that you're a shareholder with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, which is a law firm that has an office in downtown Tampa. And Dilip, thank you so much for coming on such short notice.
My pleasure.
All right. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we're the last part of the show. We are going to continue talking about immigration. Alumni of an elite high school in Tampa are distancing themselves from one of their fellow graduates, Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen. Kristen has been a high-profile defender of the Trump administration's highly scrutinized immigration policy. Yesterday, a group of alumni from Berkeley Prep School drafted a petition opposing her and calling for the school to condemn her actions. Paul Kaintic graduated from Berkeley Prep 4 years ago. He's now attending law school at Harvard. He's one of the alumni behind the petition drive. Paul, welcome to WMNF. Let me ask you, yesterday Berkeley students, grads, issued a press release. What did that press release call for regarding the treatment of children in the immigration system?
Yeah, so that press release, we had one person in particular, one of our students by the name of Ruben Siegman. When he learned about the kinds of policies that Secretary Nielsen was imposing via the press conference that she gave on Monday, he was really, really outraged. And he thought when he learned that Secretary Nielsen was actually a Berkeley alumni, that kind of triggered him in a way that he was very upset at the fact that this was someone that should have had the morals taught to us by Berkeley. And so he decided that we need to remind her of those morals. We need to remind her of where she came from. Berkeley Prep is a place where they have always said that Berkeley puts people in the world that make a positive difference. We want Secretary Nielsen to hear from these alumni and ask herself, what positive difference is she really making in this world? To think back to her fundamental values that she learned when she was an alumni or when she was a student at Berkeley. To think back, am I really doing the kind thing? Am I really doing the moral thing? I think for her, she may be caught up in the prestige of keeping her job as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. But there comes a time when, and now is the time, where she has to decide between her principles and her job security, between her basic morality and human decency and her job security. And I'm sure that because she went to Berkeley, because she was taught the things that she was taught, if she decides and tries to make that choice, that she will choose to get rid of the policy that she currently has.
So basically, as Berkeley alumni, you think that what Nielsen is doing is at odds with the values that were taught to you at Berkeley?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Berkeley is a very competitive, very, very high-achieving kind of place. They really, really push you hard. But the reason why they push you hard has always been not for the sake of just achieving alone, but so that you may benefit the world in the future. It's a philosophy of that you will do good so that you can do well. Secretary Nielsen has had a lot of success throughout her career. I guess it takes a lot to become a secretary of a major government agency. So she's done a lot of good. Now the question is she doing well? Or is she doing, she's done very well. The question is now, is she doing good for the world? And I think she's lost track of that. She has to think back to what Berkeley has taught her and reconsider the policies that she's implementing right now.
Are you asking the school to issue a statement condemning Nielsen's actions when it comes to separation of families?
Yeah, we were calling, we had an open letter that we sent actually to the headmaster of Berkeley Prep, Joe Seibold, who's a great guy. We sent him a letter calling him to condemn Nielsen's actions. On that letter, we even received over 500 signatures from different alumni from the classes of 1978 all the way until the most recent graduating class of 2018. We're calling for her to reconsider what she's doing. And we're calling for Berkeley as an institution, headed by Headmaster Joe Seibold, to tell her, hey, what you're doing is wrong. And it's antithetical to the philosophy that Berkeley had taught you. Please reconsider the things that you're doing. But yeah, we would love to have Berkeley Preparatory School's institutional support, as well as the alumni that we already have behind us.
So you've got 500 signatories to this. Do you expect that number to grow?
Yeah, I mean, that 500 signatures came in under 24 hours, right? We also raised a bunch of money for a nonprofit organization called RACES. They work to help immigrant families. We raised over $5,000 for that group in under 24 hours. We got those 500 signatures in under 24 hours. And we just kind of assume that from this point, at the pace that we're growing, the amount of signatures that we're going to get, the amount of people that we're going to get behind this movement, the amount of alumni, and not just alumni, but Tampa community members as well, that are going to flood to this thing to support it as the word kind of spreads. We think that this should increase dramatically.
And Paul, one last question. I know a lot of people who've been successful after graduating at Berkeley come back to the campus and speak to the students. Has Secretary Nielsen come back, to your knowledge? Did she ever come back? Have you ever met her, is what I'm getting at?
No. So I haven't actually met her. She graduated in the class of 1990. I graduated in the class of 2014. So we're a little bit far apart, but I don't know if she's ever come back to any of the alumni events. I don't know if she's ever spoken at a graduation or anything like that. But who knows? Maybe in the future. We'll see.
Paul, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that I should have asked you that the public needs to know?
Yeah, I'd say if this is a situation and a condition that you're not happy about the current Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security's policy of separating children from their families at the border, get involved in some way. We did it. We didn't expect much to come out of it, yet under 24 hours, we got tremendous support, 500 signatures, $5,000 raised in under 24 hours. There's a GoFundMe link that's going around. You can look to any of the Facebook pages of any of us, of myself, Paul Kaintick, of some of our other organizers like Megan McGray, last name spelled M-A-G-R-A-Y. Look to their Twitters and all that. You can find all the information right there to donate and how to get involved.
Paul Kaintick, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Great. Thank you so much, Rob.
Well, that's Paul Kaintick, who graduated from Berkeley Preparatory School 4 years ago. He's one of the alumni that is behind the petition drive asking for the school to speak out against Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who graduated from the Tampa Prep School in 1990. And they have a GoFundMe page. It's GoFundMe BPS Alumni Condemn Kirstjen Nielsen. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. Let's open up the phone lines and see where you're at. Our phone number, 813-239-9663, and our email address, dj@wmnf.org. And if there's something that you want to comment about, we can do that. I'm wondering what you think about this whole controversy. In the next hour, I think Senator Nelson has made a new statement from the Senate floor, and Sean is going to give NOLA the audio from that. We'll hear that in just a few minutes. I'm wondering about true American values. I'm just thinking, which side represents true American values in your mind? 813-239-9663. Here's something that Laura Ingraham said last night on Fox News. She's one of the Fox News commentators.
So since more illegal immigrants are rushing the border, more kids are being separated from their parents and temporarily housed. So since more illegal immigrants are rushing the border, more kids are being separated from their parents and temporarily housed in what are essentially summer camps, or as the San Diego Union-Tribune described them today, as looking like basically boarding schools.
Summer camps and boarding schools. Have you seen the pictures? Do they all resemble summer camps and boarding schools? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to David in Tampa. David, what do you think about this?
Well, hey, one thing interesting with Nielsen and Berkeley is that, Berkeley is probably one of the most expensive private schools in Tampa area. And I'm curious about whether any of her contemporaries, because she's like 47 years old, I think, signed that petition, or if it was just the younger alumni. Do you know offhand?
I don't know. I didn't look at the 500 signatures. I saw three of the people that signed the press release yesterday all have graduated in the last 5 or 6 years, I think. So they're
really?
Yeah, they're essentially the younger generation, yeah.
It would be interesting to track down Nielsen's contemporaries and get them on record to see what they say. Because, it is pretty interesting from a moral and ethical standpoint. It's interesting.
All right, David, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. Let's take some more phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And Ernie writes this, how big is the problem of child trafficking across the border? I think that's a big problem, writes Ernie. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, as you're listening to WMNF Tampa. And we're talking about the controversy involving separating parents from their children when they come across the border. Let's go to Bruce in Wekiwatchee. Hi, Bruce. What would you like to say?
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I was looking at the New York Post this morning, and they had an... I don't know if you heard about the incident in the Mexican restaurant with...
Yeah, we played some of the audio. We played some of the audio this morning.
Okay, I must have just missed that or something. But anyway, at the bottom of that article is very interesting. A statement from the... from her organization stated that she met with her constituents in a restaurant last night to discuss the immigration problems in this country. They totally, absolutely twisted the whole thing around, like she invited these people to the restaurant. Her constituents were invited to the restaurant to discuss immigration.
I see. And then
it was absolutely
Democratic, the Democratic Socialists of America came to protest her at a Mexican restaurant. And you think this now I saw the photo. It didn't look like she was meeting with constituents. She was there for 15 minutes.
It's totally twisted what they said.
Well, you're saying that this was an opportunity for her constituents to meet with her?
That's correct.
And who are her constituents since she's an appointee?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean,
I cannot believe I read that. I cannot believe they even said that.
Yeah,
because
her constituent is President Trump.
That's correct.
That's who votes
that's
for
correct.
Her. Yeah, all right. Bruce, thanks a lot. Thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Rob in Tampa. Rob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. I think probably from the pictures I've seen, it looks more like an SPCA, not a summer camp.
Yeah, I've seen more pictures of cages and then these weird blankets, these weird NASA blankets that look very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I will say from that audio tape they had, I feel bad for some of the people that are involved. It sounded as though some of the employees. I'm certainly just following their marching orders. Seem very compassionate to the kids. I mean, they can't be in a good position. But the misinformation in this country. I mean, to me, it's just astounding. I mean, I've heard some people that I know that have responded saying, "Well, it's against the law," and they really need to do a better job. I mean, all of us do in terms of just trying to provide the education that. It has nothing to do with the existing law. It has to do with the practice of the law. So, I mean, it's an interpretive kind of a process. During the Obama administration, they had some rough situations at the border too. But I certainly think that they navigated it with a little more empathy than what's going on now. And you can't tell me that some of the decision makers didn't sit and discuss this prior to it happening, saying, "Well, we're going to be separating families, and we can use that as a deterrent." So this to make it sound like it's just a happenstance that we're just enforcing a law, and this is the only means that we have. When in fact, I think it was well known how this thing was going to break out, and it's sad to say. I mean, the United States used to be the moral compass of the world, or at least I thought. We need to do a much better job. I mean, leaving, politics aside, doesn't matter how it plays out, they need to knock off this kind of behavior. It's un-American, I think.
All right, Rob, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. 813-239-9663 is our phone number, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Jeff Haynes and Frank Knox are in the back helping make this program work, and thanks to both of them. Let's go to Ken in Zephyr Hills. Hi, Ken, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hello, sir.
Hi, Ken. What would you like to say?
I'm good today. I just want to voice my opinion on what's going on with the children. And listen, there shouldn't be no international borders. This is a one-world system. I don't feel that people should be pushed out of society just because they're from another country. I don't believe in any country. The thing is, we're all human beings. I'm a Buddhist, and that's how we stand, man. Let them in. If they got poverty over there, let them come to this country and have their milk and honey, too, and share it with other people. That's all I got to say, so thank you.
All right, Ken, thanks a lot. Thanks. Well, these people are fleeing oppression, and you got to think that if things are not going well in Honduras or other countries where there are drug gangs, what would you do if you were living there? What would you do? Kevin writes this, so if we watch Fox News 24/7, it will all make perfect sense. It works for Trump, writes Kevin, making that suggestion. And then Adam writes this, the reporters asked Kirstjen Nielsen about the pictures of children, and she claimed she had not seen them, which is strange since they came from her department because reporters weren't allowed to take photos. They want to use this policy as a fear tactic, but they don't want to own it, writes Adam. And let's go to Lynn in Sarasota. Hi, Lynn, you're on. What would you like to say?
Oh, hi. I objected to the idea that the older generations would not support preventing the separation of children and families. I thought that just indicating that it might just be younger graduates who are doing that. No, I know many people who are actively against what's going on now. And we're approaching 70s, but we're totally aghast at the idea of what's happening. So that's all I wanted to say.
All right, Lynn. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Let's go to Mike in Asheville. Mike, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hello, Mr. Roy. I just have one question for you. Do you think I'm too old to join the Space Force?
No, I think you're the exact right age. Mike, thanks. Thanks.
Hey, Rob. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Well, if the Space Force had been around during the Vietnam War, I wouldn't have had to dodge it. Because I would have joined the Space Force. This is the most exciting thing since I visited Tomorrowland.
All right.
Do you think there's any chance that Trump might be off on the first rocket?
No, I don't. I don't think he meets the weight requirement. Mike, thanks a lot. Thanks for that. Let's go to Robin in Tarpon Springs. Robin, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. I'm just calling to weigh in on the situations in Central America and Honduras in general.
Sure.
Specifically, rather. And I happened to visit there a few years ago, and I went to what was then the most violent city in the world, and Honduras was something else. It's the first time I heard the term feminicida, which means someone's being killed just because they're a woman.
Mm.
And
were you in Tegucigalpa?
No, I was in San Pedro Sula,
mm-hmm.
and also out in the country. Everybody thought we were missionaries, but we weren't. We were there to look at some women's programs. And it was at night when we go to a restaurant, we had to take a taxi cab across the street, literally. I mean, there are gangs in vans going, abducting people off the street. It was absolutely, I've traveled many, many places in the world. That's the only place I was terrified.
And you can understand why people would be fleeing. You know, I was just for a brief time in the airport in Tegucigalpa, and what I noticed way across on the other side of the runway were large U.S. aircraft, perhaps a dozen or two dozen large kind of transport carriers. So the U.S., at least when I was down there in the 1980s, was backing the Honduran government. Did you notice anything about U.S. support for the Honduran government when you were there?
Well, there was just, the elections and the coups. I mean, we supported coups, and it's a mess. And it's, you know, a lot of it we helped to create, either directly or indirectly, depending on your point of view, I guess. But one thing I did notice is even when we left the city and went up into the countryside, it was a very pristine, you know, people, adobe stoves and dirt floors and chickens inside and outside and all that. And, you know, no connection really to the outside world, but saw on the ride up all these pristine forests being clear cut, all these hillsides just being clear cut, which is creating floods and all this, because what's happening is a lot of international companies are having a strong presence there. In this village where we were, the villagers were trying to protect themselves against a Chinese gold mining company that was polluting their water source. And after we left, masked gunmen came in and actually killed someone that we knew, that we had met while we were there. And, it's easy to pay someone to intimidate, you know, someone with nothing living in the countryside. It was just a very, very disturbing experience. And, you know, I completely understand people not wanting to to be there. There's a
okay. And Robin, we're out of time. Robin, I'm so sorry.
It's not going to flip a switch and all
right.
of a sudden it's a.
Robin, I'm so sorry. We're out of time. But if you want to comment about today's show. You can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comment back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up on the Midpoint program. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa St. Peter.